Well, our service this evening is slightly different. Every year, on the Sunday closest to, for the last few years, on the Sunday closest to Reformation Day, which is yesterday, I give a talk on a character from church history. And of course, today is All Saints Day, so in some ways, we're looking at one of the saints from the past. And the reason I do that is because I want to encourage you to read church history, to read about the Christians who've gone before us. We're not the first people to have gone through the stuff that we're going through. We've got 2,000 years of believers since Christ who have lived, and some have lived remarkable lives because of their faith in Christ. Second reason is because as a minister, I spend a lot of my time in the Bible, and it's good for me to read a bit about church history and to be reminded of some of these people from the past. And so today, this evening, we're going to look at William Wilberforce. I've titled the talk, Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, a biography of William Wilberforce. And the reason I've titled it that is because during this past year particularly, the Black Lives Matter movement has been remarkable. It's a political and a social movement that advocates for non-violent civil disobedience against incidents of police brutality and or racially motivated violence against black people. It began in 2013, but it's been remarkable at the speed by which it's become international. And of course, since the global George Floyd protests earlier this year, it's gained a lot of attention. That was after the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. And there was worldwide outrage of the incident. And since then, sportsmen and sportswomen have taken the knee before matches. Premier League football shirts have had a Black Lives Matter badge on them. And we've seen protests and the public removal of statues in this country of former slave traders and those who prospered from slavery. I haven't said much about Black Lives Matter. I've not said much about the racism that movement seeks to eradicate. And so tonight I want to address that whole area. But I want to do so from the side, not from head on. I don't know whether I'm qualified to speak about it head on. It's a huge movement, and a lot's been written and spoken about it, particularly even this last month. It's been Black History Month. But I want to look at it from the side by looking at somebody from church history, somebody who stood against the flow of society for the benefit of his fellow man. I want to speak about William Wilberforce, so we might learn something from him and be inspired by him. You see, in an age when slavery and when the slave trade was accepted as normal across the world, William Wilberforce knew that Black Lives Matter, and he did something about it. I think the best way I can begin this evening is by transporting you back in time to the House of Commons on Monday, the 23rd of February, 1807. The slave trade had been debated in the House of Commons year after year. For 20 years, the evils of the trade had been brought before MPs. The bills proposed for the abolition of the slave trade had come and gone, rejected, delayed, abandoned by Parliament, And once again, on that Monday afternoon, the arguments for abolition were put forward. And the big argument was the argument for justice and humanity. That the House of Commons could no longer accept, and this is a quote, that British subjects are allowed to tear by violence from their home their fellow creatures, to take them from their family and from their friends, to convert them from free men into slaves, and to subject them for the remainder of their lives to the arbitrary will and wanton wickedness of others. And once again, the House of Commons had to endure the arguments against abolition, which was namely that if the slave trade was abolished, it would have a significant economic impact on the country. It would lead to unemployment, and it would lead to the insurrection of slaves abroad. But on that day, there was one crucial difference. Every member of Parliament knew that the bill would be passed. It had been debated already in the House of Lords and had come into the House of Commons, an unusual procedure. And its passage that day would be hailed by the Prime Minister of the country as the most glorious measure that had ever been adopted by a legislative body in the world. Before the vote, MP after MP stood up in the debate, and as they do so, man after man singled out one person as the architect of the victory, and that was William Wilberforce. Sir John Doyle referred to the unwearied industry of this man and his indefatigable zeal, which washed this foul stain from the pure ermine of the national character. Lord Mahon said his name will descend to the latest posterity with never fading honour. And Mr. Fawkes said he looked with reverence and respect to a man who has raised a monument to his fame, founded on the basis of universal benevolence. The climax of the debate came when the Attorney General, Sir Samuel Romilly, contrasted Wilberforce with the tyrant Napoleon across the Channel. He said the Emperor might seem, quote, when he sat upon his throne to have reached the summit of human ambition and the pinnacle of earthly happiness. But in his bed, his solitude must be tortured and his rest banished by the recollection of the blood he had spilled and the oppression he had committed. By contrast, Wilberforce would that night retire into the comfort of his delighted and happy family and lie down on his bed, reflecting on the innumerable voices that would be raised in every quarter of the world to bless him. How much more pure and permanent happiness must he enjoy in the consciousness of having preserved so many millions of his fellow creatures than the man with whom he had been compared? As Sir Samuel finished his speech, it was followed by an unheard-of event in Parliament. The House of Commons rose almost to a man and turned to Wilberforce, the MP, in a burst of parliamentary cheers, suddenly above the roar of hear, 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 and quite out of order, three hurrahs echoed and echoed while Wilberforce sat head bowed, tears streaming down his face. 4 o'clock in the morning, February the 24th, 1807, the House divided. Ayes, 283. Noes, 16. Majority for the abolition of the slave trade, 267. No one at the time expected such a huge majority, least of all Wilberforce, who put it down to God's immediate providence. Well, that was the famous night, famous morning, should I say, of the abolition of the slave trade. But I want to turn from that evening now to ask two questions. Who was this man that was honoured like that? honored that evening, that morning, as the human spearhead for the abolition of the slave trade. And what was the key to his life? Who was he, and what was the key to his life? Let me give you a brief overview of William Wilberforce. He was born 24th of August, 1759, in Hull. He was the only son of a wealthy merchant who had been mayor of Hull a couple of times. He attended Hull Grammar School under the tutelage of Joseph Milner. And Milner would have a big impact on his life later on. His father died when he was nearly nine, and his mother couldn't cope, so she sent him to live with an aunt and uncle in London. They were evangelical Christians. He was sent to an evangelical school, and he began to become an evangelical, a Methodist. His mother, who was a High Church of England woman, was distraught at the idea of him being a Methodist, so brought him back to Hull when he was 12 and didn't send him to the grammar school again because the headmaster had become a Methodist, and so sent him to a non-religious school. His religious zeal diminished, and he became a party-loving man. His grandfather and uncle died, and all the wealth of the family came to him. He became a very wealthy man at a very young age. And so he didn't need to work, didn't need to study. And he looked back later in his life and said, he was just a layabout, he was just idle. In 1776, he went to Cambridge University, where his lovable and popular character made him popular on the social scene. He didn't do much work. He partied his time away, but he did make one important friend, William Pitt. And at the end of the university time, he and William Pitt, both aged 21, decided to run for Parliament. He spent £8,000, which was a massive amount of money in those days, in order to get elected, because he bought various votes from various people. Pitt got elected, and within 4 years, William Pitt was the Prime Minister of England. Wilberforce, when he entered Parliament, resolved to be a no-party man. He resolved to be an independent. You could do that back then. There were two broad parties, the Whigs and the Tories, but they were a broad coalition of people. It wasn't like it is today. And he wanted to be an independent so he could vote with his conscience. When Pitt became Tory Prime Minister, he was often swayed towards Pitt, but he wanted to be able to vote independently of the government if necessary. In 1784, he left his seat in Hull. He was elected as MP for the large and influential seat of Yorkshire, and he kept that seat until 1812, and then he took a small constituency down in Sussex until he left Parliament in 1824. But the turning point in his life came after he became an MP in 1784-1785. In the October, when he was 25, in 1784, he on parliamentary recess, he took a trip to Europe with his mother, with his family, and he decided to take along a friend, Isaac Milner. He'd known Milner in Cambridge days. He was the younger brother of the headmaster in Hull. And when they began the trip, he discovered that Milner had become an evangelical Christian, which shocked him because his view of what that meant didn't line up with his experience of Milner. It wasn't what an evangelical Christian he thought should be. And on the trip, they played cards and they talked a lot about Christianity. On the way back, they read a book that was there, called The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul by Philip Doddridge. It was a remarkable time. Wilberforce and Milner read that to each other as they travelled back, and by the time he'd reached London in the February, he'd become convinced about the Christian faith. Don't think he would say he was converted then, but he was intellectually convinced. That summer, he went abroad again, as many of the MPs did, and he took with him Milner again, and they talked on their trip down into Europe and on the trip back. And by the time he got back home to London that summer, he said his intellectual ascent had become profound conviction. Wilberforce was converted. And that great change, as he called it in his life, had a remarkable effect on his thinking and on his behavior. He began to rise up early in the morning to pray and to study the Bible. When he wasn't in Parliament, they used to have these long recesses from Parliament where the MPs would go into the country or go to Europe. And he didn't seem to have a house at the time, and so would just stay with friends. And he would find a nice country house somewhere, and he would spend his time reading and studying the Bible, 9-10 hours a day. It became his best-loved book. He learned passages of it by heart. There's a story which one of his biographers tells that he would, on his walk to Parliament, he would recite the 119th Psalm. So he was serious about Bible memorization. His behavior changed. He stopped playing cards. He stopped gambling. He stopped attending gentlemen's clubs. He stopped his annual subscription to the horses, so horse racing, and transferred that to a hospital. He became very generous with his money. He was a very wealthy man. And he decided that when after becoming a Christian, he just looked at his wealth and said, I don't like this sort of thing. Don't like being as wealthy as I am. I want to be generous with the stuff I've got. And so he started giving a lot of his money away. He gave it to, gave thousands and thousands of pounds a year away. So there was a few years where he gave more away than actually he got back by income. Paid off the debts of people. He supported education and missions and hospitals. In a year of food shortages, he gave to charity more than, like I said, his own yearly income. He was exceptionally hospitable. One of the funny stories you read about is the fact that he couldn't sack any of his servants, even though a good number of them seemed to be incompetent. His heart was filled with charity and love for other people. After his conversion, Wilberforce didn't know whether to continue as an MP or not. The evangelicalism or Methodism or religious enthusiasm, they all were kind of synonymous terms back in Wilberforce's day. That was frowned upon by the upper classes who Wilberforce mixed with. William Pitt's good friend tried to talk him out of his new faith because he said, you'll be useless in Parliament. So what did Wilberforce do? He went to speak to his good friend, John Newton. He'd known Newton back in his younger days, and so he went to speak to him. Newton was a minister at St. Mary's Woolnoth in London. But Wilberforce was so worried of what other people would think when he went to speak to Newton that he decided to walk around the block twice before he actually went in and had the courage to speak to him. But when he spoke to him, Newton told him to stay in politics and stay as an MP. 2 years later, Newton wrote to him and said this, quote, "It's hoped and believed that the Lord has raised you up for the good of his church and for the good of the nation." How true that was. And so Wilberforce decided to stay as an MP. And he continued with more diligence and more conscientiousness than ever before. But his views had changed. His political views were informed by his evangelical faith. He didn't leave his evangelical faith at the door of Parliament when he went in to debate and to vote. All his views were affected by his faith. He sought to promote Christianity and Christian ethics in the country, in personal life, but also in public life. And so the two parties, broad parties, didn't trust him. The slightly more radical Whigs didn't like his conservatism. and the Tories thought his evangelicalism was a bit radical and undermined the church and the state. Well, Wilberforce continued as an MP. And when he continued as an MP, he sought to do two main things. In 1787, a group of abolitionists, headed up by a guy called Thomas Clarkson, who was a Quaker, met with Wilberforce and asked him about the issue of abolition and said, would you take that to Parliament? See, these abolitionists had looked at Wilberforce and thought, if the slave trade is going to be abolished, we need somebody in Parliament who's going to spearhead the campaign. And they looked at Wilberforce's faith and beliefs. They looked at his character. And they said, he's the man. At the time, there were maybe only 30 MPs out of 530 who were in favour of abolition. They looked at Wilberforce and his gifts and thought, you're the man for the job. Anyway, Wilberforce took time to pray and to think about it. And after praying and thinking, he sensed a call from God. He wrote this in a journal entry in October 1787. He said, quote, God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners or morals. Those were the two things he stood for in Parliament. He stood for the suppression of the slave trade. In fact, he began to read and study about the slave trade and to see the horror of it for himself. The trade had been going on since the 16th century. Thousands and thousands of men and women were kidnapped from the west coast of Africa and taken to the West Indies every year. In 1787, it's estimated that 100,000 people were transported. And that middle passage crossing the Atlantic was so horrific, and the conditions were so bad that perhaps 10 or 15% of people died on the trip. Well, with encouragement from his friend William Pitt, the Prime Minister, Wilberforce in 1787, at the end of the year, gave notice to put forward a bill to abolish the slave trade. In 1789, he spoke to the House of Parliament and about how he came to his conviction, and he said this, quote, I confess to you, so enormous, so dreadful, so irremediable did its wickedness appear that my own mind was completely made up for abolition. But he didn't point the finger of blame at other people. He took the blame on himself. Later that year, in another debate, he said this, I mean not to accuse anyone, but to take the shame upon myself, in common indeed with the whole Parliament of Great Britain, for having suffered this horrid trade to be carried on under their authority. We are all guilty. We ought all to plead guilty and not to excuse ourselves by throwing the blame on others. That's the way that Wilberforce approached the debates in Parliament. That's how he started off. We've heard about the abolition evening in 1807. That was 20 years after the debates started. It took him 20 years of battle before Parliament was convinced to abolish the trade. And that was only to abolish the trade. It would take another 26 years before slavery was outlawed in the British Empire. Wilberforce won the victory over the slave trade in February 1807 at the age of 47. John Pollock, one of his biographers, says this, quote, his achievement brought him a personal moral authority with public and Parliament above any living man. After that evening, when the slave trade was abolished, he became the conscience of England. If an MP wanted to put forward a bill in Parliament and wanted the moral vote, as it were, they would appeal to Wilberforce and say, we want you on our side, because we think that our bill will then have more gravitas. He campaigned against slavery. He campaigned, even after the abolition of the slave trade, they started to implement it, and there was lots of issues with that, and he campaigned against, campaigned for that as well. But he also campaigned for the reformation of manners and morals in the country. There were so many good works and reforms that he was involved in. He was involved in penal reform, political reform, laws on duelling, bear baiting, using boys as chimney sweeps. He was involved in setting up the RNLI, the lifeboats. He was involved in setting up the RSPCA. And he was involved in things like the Bible Society and the Christian Mission Society. And he even got involved in messy relational issues as well. Like, he was involved in the unsuccessful mediation between Queen Caroline and her estranged husband, King George IV. He was involved in all these different things, in so many good causes. Someone said that the good causes attach themselves to Wilberforce like pins to a magnet. One little example is when two Manchester men wanted help in exposing the cruel usage of children in cotton spinning in Manchester, it was to Wilberforce that they turned. That was his parliamentary life. At the beginning of the parliamentary life, he was a single man, but then in 1797, he married. He was in his mid-30s at the time, and he married Barbara Spooner. After an 8-day romance, he got engaged and was married a month later. They had 6 children, and they were a wonderful distraction and support in his political work. But they were also the cause of lots of heartache and grief, as we'll come to in a bit. Well, Wilberforce continued as an MP until 1824. Then he retired a little to the country, but still was involved in the campaigns until finally, 1833, 29th of July, he died and went to be with his Lord. I should say that 3 days before he died, he heard the wonderful news that slavery was going to be abolished in the country. There's a lovely story about the debate beginning, and Wilberforce was told that the debate was going to begin, and he was sat down to eat at the time, and he jumped up from his seat and went, "Hear, hear, hear, hear," as the parliamentary MPs would do at the start of a debate. Died 29th of July 1833 and was buried in August that year in Westminster Abbey, next to his friend William Pitt. Well, that's the overview of his life. And I want to turn now from that to ask the question, what was the key to his life? What was the key to his success? In 1831, towards the end of his life, he wrote to the Anti-Slavery Society. They were meeting. He wasn't able to be with them. But he wrote this. He said, quote, "Our motto must continue to be perseverance. And ultimately, I trust the Almighty will crown our efforts with success." I want to suggest that the key to his life, the motto of his life, was and always had been perseverance. 40 years earlier, in 1791, when he had moved a bill for abolition, he said, quote, "Whatever may be its success, I have attached my happiness to their cause, the cause of the slaves, and shall never relinquish it." He closed his speech that day by saying this, Never will we desist till we have wiped away this scandal from the Christian name, released ourselves from the load of guilt under which we at present labour, and extinguish every trace of this bloody traffic of which our posterity, looking back to the history of these enlightened times, will scarcely believe that it has been suffered to exist so long, a disgrace and dishonour to this country. We do. And he didn't. He didn't give up. He persevered year after year, defeat after defeat in Parliament. He kept going. When his opponents thought they'd knocked him down and won, he seemed to spring back up again. He had what one person said seemed like a steel spring within his feeble frame. One of them in particular put it like this: it's necessary, one of his opponents put it like this, I quote, "It's necessary to watch him, as he's blessed with a very sufficient quantity of that enthusiastic spirit, which so far from yielding that it grows more vigorous from blows." So they knock him down, he gets back up, and he gets back up even stronger. He persevered. And he needed to persevere. Let me give you three reasons why he needed to persevere. He needed to persevere because of the opposition that he faced to abolishing the slave trade. When you read about the opposition that he faced, it was significant, it was constant, it was public, it was personal. People attacked his policies, and people attacked his character. He lost friends, he lost reputation, and on occasions his life was threatened. Now that's no kind of general threat. These threats were specific. The Prime Minister of England was assassinated in Parliament in 1812. Slave-owning MPs would argue with Wilberforce in Parliament, and their argument would, generally speaking, go like this. They'd say, well, yes, it's not a good trade, isn't this? But it's necessary. You know, if we don't have it, then power and wealth will go to other nations, like the Spanish or the Portuguese. They're not going to abolish the slave trade. It'll lead to unemployment. Thousands of sailors, thousands of people in Liverpool rely upon the trade. It'll lead to insurrection among slaves in the West Indies. You know, Wilberforce, if you are patriotic, if you love Britain as you claim to do, you won't abolish the slave trade or campaign to abolish it. That was the sort of argument that people would put against him, that MPs would put against him. And his conduct would be misrepresented and his views misconstrued, not only in Parliament, but across the country. They produce these little pamphlets at the time with cartoons on, and you can see various cartoons and caricatures of Wilberforce cavorting with black women. Rumours would be spread that he had a black mistress or he owned slaves, and that actually he was a hypocritical rascal. That he was actually out for himself. He didn't really do anything for other people. One of the worst criticisms that I read about was a public criticism from a William Cobbett MP. He was MP for Oldham. In 1823, he had a real go at Wilberforce for caring more about the slaves than he did about British wage slaves. He said this, quote, "You seem to have a great affection for the fat and lazy and laughing and singing and dancing Negroes. But never have you done one single act in favour of the labourers of this country. You make your appeal in Piccadilly, London, amongst those who are wallowing in luxuries, proceeding from the labour of the people. You should have gone to the gravel pits and made your appeal to the wretched creatures with bits of sacks around their shoulders and with hairbands round their legs. You should have gone to the roadside and made you appeal to the emaciated, half-dead things who were there cracking stones to make the roads as level as a dive for the tax-eaters to ride on. What an insult it is, and what an unfeeling, what a cold-blooded hypocrite must he be that can send it forth. What an insult to call upon people under the name of free British labourers, to appeal to them on behalf of black slaves, when these free British labourers, these poor, mocked, degraded wretches, will be happy to lick the dishes and bowls out of which the black slaves have breakfasted, dined, or supped. That's the sort of thing that was spoken against him. In 1820, after the issue with Queen Caroline that he tried to get involved in and try to mediate in some way, he said this: "What a lesson it is to a man not to set his heart on popularity, when after 40 years disinterested public service, I am believed by the bulk to be a hypocritical rascal. Or what a comfort it is to have to fly for refuge to a God of unchangeable truth and love." See, how are you going to cope with that kind of criticism? Well, you need to persevere through that. You need deep, strong perseverance to keep going through that kind of criticism and those kind of obstacles. He also needed perseverance because of family difficulties. You know, if things are good at home with the family, then you can face quite a bit of opposition outside the house. When stuff is hard at home, it makes life more difficult. Barbara Spooner, who Wilberforce married, was a very different character to him. They were very well suited to each other, and he loved her dearly. But she was much more reserved than he was, much tighter with money, she was less comfortable with people. And in 1800, she contracted typhoid when she was pregnant. She almost died. And she recovered from that, but she was never the same again. Something happened to her that wrecked her nerves and her general health. And she worried a lot. She was anxious whenever Wilberforce was away from her for quite a period of time. And so at home, he had a wife who needed him. While his children gave him a lot of joy, his oldest son, William, gave him a lot of grief as well. He was a lovable character, just like his dad, but he lacked any of the self-discipline that his dad had. And as a result, he was taken for a ride by idle and wicked young men. He spent his money foolishly. And in the end, he ended up squandering a lot of the family wealth on a farming venture that went wrong. His daughter Barbara, who he loved dearly, died young. She died in 1821 at 32 years old. And the grief he felt was strong. He wrote about it in his diary, and he said this, quote, "Only the sure persuasion of Barbara's happiness has taken away the sting of death." Those sort of family difficulties just made life tougher for Wilberforce. I should mention his friends as well. Whilst he lost his daughter, he also lost his good friend William Pitt in 1806, a year before the abolition of the slave trade. He lost his best friend, Henry Thornton, these guys were eyeball to eyeball in Parliament. And yet he passed away in 1815, and he had to continue the slog by himself. He also needed perseverance because of difficulties with his health. He was a sickly child. He never had a strong constitution. He was a small man. But as he got older, he had a number of serious health issues. When he was 29, he was diagnosed with colitis. And the doctor had to prescribe him morphine, and he was on morphine tablets from the age of 29 to the end of his life at 73. And those daily morphine tablets led to a buildup of morphine poisoning in his system. And so as he got older, he became more slovenly, more untidy, more careless, more absent-minded. It's amazing he could do the work that he did. At a similar time, his eyesight began to go worse. And so he would say that he struggled to read in a morning. He found writing hard at times. And his poor eyesight meant that he dressed in an even more shabbily manner. He had problems with his lungs and with breathing. And around 1812, he began to experience a curvature of his spine. So if you see photographs of Wilberforce, you'll see him with his head, you'll see him sat at an angle with his head on his chest. And what happened was that one shoulder began to slope. His head fell forward a little more each year until it rested on his chest, unless he lifted it by a conscious movement. And one of his biographers said he could have looked, quote, he could have looked grotesque were it not for the charm of his face and the smile which hovered about his mouth. For the rest of his life, from 1812 until 1833, he wore a brace in order to keep his body upright. And nobody would know what he wore it underneath his clothes, and nobody would have known about it, except he had two braces, and he left his better one at a friend's house where he was staying. Those are significant health issues that he had to battle with and persevere through. So when you put all this together, the battles in Parliament and in public, the difficulties with his family and the issues with his health, where do you get that kind of perseverance from that will keep going through all of that? To abolish the slave trade and to seek the abolition of slavery and to do all the good things that he did. Well, I think it came from three places, and I'll finish with this. The first place it came from is what Wilberforce called the peculiar doctrines of Christianity. In 1797, he wrote a book called A Practical View of the Prevailing Religious System of Professed Christians. And the book became a bestseller. Within 6 months, it had gone through 5 editions and had sold 7,500 copies. And in the book, Wilberforce outlines his view of real Christianity. He said the peculiar doctrines of Christianity give rise to true desires for spiritual things, which in turn breaks sin in our lives and lead to a change in behavior and ultimately to a change in the nation. So peculiar doctrines giving rise to spiritual affections, desires, and those desires break the power of sin in our lives and lead to a change in behavior, which ultimately lead to a change in the country. And the peculiar doctrines which he outlines in the book, which he says are central to Christianity, are these: human depravity, sinful nature, the atonement of Christ and the need for his sacrifice, the necessity of the new birth and being born again, justification by grace through faith, the fruit of a godly life, and the authority of the Bible. And he wrote this book because he said most Christians in England at the time were nominal. And they were nominal because they'd forgotten these doctrines. See, they thought, he said, that Christianity was about behavior, not belief. It was about doing, not doctrine. And so he says they'd lost the power to live a moral life. You see, for Wilberforce, life revolved around God. God was at the center of life. And loving other people was a result of living for God. You see, Wilberforce couldn't consider a Christianity which said it's about how you live your life. Loving people. He did love people, but he said that's a consequence of my faith. That in itself isn't my faith. One example of this was he was approached by some radicals to join their cause in reform. People who wanted parliamentary reform and penal reform and other reforms in the country, and he agreed with what they wanted to do, but he refused to join them. You see, he agreed with the changes, but he said they must take place from Christian principles. He said this: if you take what? You take away the principles, you take away the power. See, radicals wanted change without religion. They wanted the fruit of Christianity, as Wilberforce saw it, not the root. And so Wilberforce said this, quote, "Their doctrine must fail the very people whom they intended to help." Wilberforce would say, if you want to help people, if you want to make people's lives better, if you want to fight for equality, if you want to fight for change and reform, then you need to first of all believe in the doctrines of Christianity. That will give you the power which will lead to the change. Second, where did his perseverance come from? It came from the belief that his views were right. You know, when you're standing for something year after year and you're facing opposition from this side and from that side, a deep conviction that you're in the right gives you a power to keep going. Wilberforce said this, quote, "The grand object of my parliamentary existence is the abolition of the slave trade. Before this great cause, all others dwindle in my eyes. And I must say that the certainty that I am right here adds greatly to the self-assurance with which I exert myself in asserting it." When John Wesley was 87 years old in 1790, he wrote to Wilberforce and said this, quote, "Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you'll be worn out by the opposition of man and devils. But if God be for you, who can be against you?" See, when Wilberforce appealed to Parliament to abolish the slave trade, it was the rightness, the justice, the humanity of the bill that he commended to them. He knew he was right, even if very few people to begin with agreed with him. He knew that God was on his side. That gave him power to persevere. But finally, the third thing which gave him power to persevere was his God-given character. You see, in putting Wilberforce in the position that he did, God was using the right man for the right occasion. You know, sometimes when I read these biographies of these great saints of the past, I look and I go, I wish I was like that, but I'm not. Well, one way to look at these people is to see that God used their particular mixture of gifts at that time to help them persevere and press on and do what God called them to do. And God will do the same with you. With your mixture of gifts, he will enable you to persevere and press on and do what he has called you to do. What were his gifts? Well, when you read about Wilberforce, you see someone who's just eloquent, amusing, and big-hearted. People liked him. He was a very likable character. He was good company. He was funny and witty. He was always interested in things. He found everything amusing. He would walk around the house humming and singing all the time. When he was leaving a house in an evening and saying goodbye to people, his wife would be outside, out the door, and he would stay an extra hour just saying goodbyes because he was that kind of character. He looked on people, as one person said, quote, through a happy medium. He was no backbiter with his tongue. He always saw the sunny side of people. One story which I found amusing was that he met William Gladstone, the MP, before a parliamentary vote. Wilberforce had stepped down by then, and young William Gladstone had come to see him before a vote on slavery. They had a good time together, fun time together, and then Gladstone promptly went off to Parliament and voted in favour of slavery and against what Wilberforce would do. People loved spending time with him, whether they agreed with him or not. He loved the Lake District, and on one holiday he stayed in a house close to William and Dorothy Wordsworth. He and 19 other people stayed in that house for 6 weeks. When he moved somewhere, he took this whole household with him, servants and everybody. It was incredible. Well, after meeting him, Dorothy Wordsworth said this: "There never lived on earth, I am sure, a man of sweeter temper than Mr. Wilberforce. He's made up of benevolence and loving kindness, and though shattered in constitution and feeble in body, he is as lively and animated as in the days of his youth." The poet Robert Southey said this about him: "I never saw any other man who seemed to enjoy such a perpetual serenity and sunshine of spirit. In conversing with him, you feel assured that there's no guile in him, that if ever there was a good man and a happy man, he was one." And at home, he would always be wanting to play games and go for runs on the lawn with his children. In fact, at one point, William, his oldest son, damaged his foot with a cricket ball while they were playing a game on the grass. And this was at an age when fathers didn't spend time with their children like that. He wouldn't mind being disturbed in his debates and talks with Henry Thornton, his good friend. They were debating seriously about the slave trade and slavery and how to abolish it. And then suddenly a child would come bursting in and he'd go, "Oh yeah, let's play catch. Let's go for a run on the grass. Let's go and play." And then come back. In Parliament, he had a reputation for witty asides and giving good speeches and being the noisiest member. One of the MPs gave a speech which Wilberforce found hilarious and so funny they actually fell off his seat and made quite a stir in Parliament. He'd jump up in Parliament and make asides, and when he was so witty and could be sarcastic if he wanted to, but he never used that in a bad way. He was a powerful speaker. James Boswell, the author, witnessed Wilberforce's eloquence in the House of Commons, and he said this, quote, "I saw what seemed a mere shrimp mount upon the table. But as I listened to him speak, he grew and grew until the shrimp became a whale." Wilberforce's happy, genial, amusing, eloquent gifts were used by God to help him to press on, to help him to convince people who maybe wouldn't have been convinced by what Hannah Moore called grave and severe divines. Because they liked Wilberforce, they would listen to him, they would engage with him, and he would persuade them. Well, that's William Wilberforce. What a man that God used to abolish such an awful trade. I think we're going to